with Gav Thompson.
Hello, welcome to the Do Lectures podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Today on season 4, episode 4 of Living Your Best Life, we talked to Emily Holden about a very sensitive subject, but a very common subject, which is infertility. I met Emily at the Do Lectures last summer, and like a lot of people that go to the Do Lectures, she was facing a crossroads. And in her case, it was coming to terms for her and her husband that they couldn't have children and that they were facing a future of not being able to be biological parents. And we had some very open and honest chats about it. And I thought she should share her story and her insight with a wider audience, which is why she is on today's show talking about living your best life, but obviously looking at it through a lens of something that wasn't entirely what she had planned in her vision of living her best life. It's a really honest conversation, but I think, yeah, it's really important, and she handles it incredibly well. So, yeah, please sit back, grab a coffee, put your feet up and listen to Emily Holden talking about living her best life. So welcome to the Do Lectures podcast, Living Your Best Life, Emily Holden. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. We met at the Do Lectures in the summer, and one of the things that I do when I'm at the Do Lectures is often ask people kind of why they're here, what brought you here, and I most of the time there's usually a kind of reason, and it's often sort of crossroads. People have sort of things have changed in their life, sometimes work-related, sometimes personal-related, and they often find themselves at the Do Lectures trying to kind of re-plot the course or re-navigate, and, it's an amazing thing, as you know, you're there, a hundred of us, and everyone's got a story to tell, and you know, most people, I think that going to the Do Lectures is it's kind of life-changing or life-affirming. And what was interesting when we talked is that I knew that I was about to do this, not about to, I wish I'd been about to, but I knew that I was soon going to do a new series on Living Your Best Life. And actually, your story is not an obvious take on that for reasons we're about to find out about. But I thought the way you were really honest in answering the question and about a subject that is, fairly sensitive, very personal, and still, as I'm sure we're about to discuss, is still quite, taboo is probably a bit strong, but some people just don't like talking about it. And as people will know by the time I've got to this podcast, they'll have seen the blurb. We're going to talk about your infertility and your and your husband's, aren't able to have kids, and that's a pretty chunky fork in the road. So we're going to get to that. But by way of intro, please tell us who you are, where you come from, and just give us a bit of context to who Emily is.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, I remember at the Do having a very meaningful big hug around the fire with you.
There's plenty of those.
Plenty of those, yeah. well, I suppose my story is not really that extraordinary. It's just I don't think people talk about the struggles that they have when they go through various things. I mean, some challenges in life, there's narratives everywhere. But I think when it comes to struggling to start a family, like you say, I don't know if taboo is the right word, but it's difficult. And I understand, because it's a very personal thing. And it's kind of like deeply embedded in the way you fit into society and your self-worth, I think, for men and women, but I'm a woman, so I'll tell it from my side of the story. And I guess I'm just a normal person, and my life was going on a path, and I was enjoying myself, and I met someone, and we got married. And when it came to the time for us to try to start having a family, that's when it just became challenging. And I suppose, like all these things, you kind of hear rumors that some people can't have children, in the same way that you hear rumors that some people just get struck down by a heart attack or hit by a car, and you just think, oh, that's tragic, but it probably won't happen to me. And then it did. And I think for me, one of the difficulties was, and I think probably for a lot of people that I've spoken to who've got similar stories, that if no one else is talking about it, you feel very alone, and you feel like there's something wrong with you, and you just don't know how to talk about it. And it's this huge thing that consumes every minute of your day, but you can't talk about it. So it was important to me at the time to find people who were talking about it, which is why I feel a kind of a responsibility to do the same now that I feel like I'm through the worst.
Yeah, no, good on you. I mean, I would agree. I've never had to deal with it personally. I'm very lucky to have three kids, you know, blessed. But I know with friends of mine, as we all do, who aren't able to have kids, and it's I do think it is one of those things that it is a bit awkward, you know. And
it's really awkward, like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the more people talk about it, the more, you know, you can tell your story, and you know, everyone can understand it. That just, I mean, again, I don't even know enough to know. I just know that, you know, feeling othered, feeling like, you know, this thing sort of happened to you, and you feel isolated and not, you know, not understood, can't be helpful. So I think it's good that we're having this chat. And so, just to give us some context, you were you'd got a fab job working in the wine business. You were sort of, you know, probably living your best life at that point, as far as the criteria of people in their early 30s have for living their best lives, right? You know, you've met your husband, you've got a great job, life's pretty good, you were working in an area that you're quite passionate about, so...
Yeah.
And like probably all of us, you know, probably feeling a bit smug, maybe. I don't know, I did in those early...
It's hard to remember. But yeah, I definitely felt like, hey, this is great. And I suppose... Yeah, I met my husband in my sort of mid to late 20s. So I didn't feel, well, personally, but like that was perfect, because I'd had like loads of fun and met somebody that was great. We got married. And the thing that I think back on quite often, and this potentially my imagination, but I've heard it echoed through other people's stories, is there was definitely a sense of there's no rush to get married. There's no rush to get a boyfriend. You're still young. And of course I was, and I felt young. And then I met someone, and then we did get married. And I remember when we got married, everyone was like, oh, don't rush into having kids. I got married at 31, I think. Don't rush into having kids. Enjoy this special time together. And I was like, yeah, we're going to bloody enjoy it. And we did. Mm. And, you know, we lived in London. We went on great holidays, and it was just a good time. And then suddenly all my friends were like, oh, by the way, I'm pregnant. And I was like, oh God, is this a thing? We talk about everything else, but we didn't talk about the fact that we were you know. And I kind of felt like, oh gosh, okay, this is interesting. People are starting to have children. And it was really only a matter of a couple of years between getting married and being told, hey, chill out, enjoy yourself, to trying for a baby, not succeeding, having a miscarriage, and then being told I was too old to have IVF treatment on the NHS. It was
quite a lot to unpick there. Just one question that's sort of in my mind, it might be in some of our listeners' minds, and it's a sort of silly, even asking it makes me feel silly, but maybe that's part of the stigma we have to unpick here, which is, when you met your husband, and when you know, that thing where you meet and you go through that lovely process of getting to know each other, and you share your dreams about life, and then, you know, when you sort of get engaged, and did you sort of share a vision for the future that was definitely having kids? I mean, what was, I guess the question I'm trying to get to is, which is a silly one, but what was his sort of attitude to, you know, I know some of my friends, male and female, who, you know, they were, despite what advice you were given, they were kind of keen to get on with the kids thing, and, you know, was some, again, maybe more men than women were a bit like, you know, there's no hurry for that kind of thing. Where was he at on that kind of spectrum of attitude to becoming a parent?
He was definitely like, hey, yeah, let's do it at some point, but no rush. And I wasn't really desperately in a rush to have kids either. I think probably looking back, we both felt probably genuinely, well, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I do think that was just the naivety of youth, because I probably said that to myself and to friends, but I always thought it was going to happen, right? And it's an interesting point you make, because I do think that there's a really unfortunate fact of biology that women will find it easier to get pregnant when they're younger. And that just goes against everything that we are working towards in terms of like equality and the narratives and the way that we want to get ahead in our career. And also goes a bit against, I don't know if it's male biology or the male narrative, because men just don't seem to be in such a hurry, because
They have a lot left to do with the process. So
yeah,
so it's and a bit more transactional, maybe.
It's a very difficult conversation to have in this really empowered, well, hopefully more empowered world for women. Be like, yeah, but I'm not going to have children for much longer. And also, when you're in your late 20s and your relationship's quite new, you don't want to scare other people off, and you don't really know what you want necessarily. And
there's that that cliche of, it's a horrible cliche, really. And the whole kind of the clock's ticking, the body, the biological clock, you know, all that. It's the sort of thing your granny would say to you. You're like, it's a, anyway, sorry. So the age thing. So you're 30, because I did know this, although, which is above the age of 35, you are classified as an old mum, I think, in
geriatric.
Geriatric. That's a lovely expression. Brilliant. Genius.
I knew about that because, you know, I had friends who were older than me, and I just found that hilarious. It was just something funny until it applied to me. And then I was like, oh my God. Because at 35, you are actually still really a young person. But I was suddenly made to feel like, well, it's kind of, no one was really outwardly rude to me, but well, it, you know, you did leave it too late to have kids. And if you are going to come to the NHS at 35, then, well, you know, you're just past it. Unfortunately,
again, we're probably getting on to some quite sort of personal territory here, but you hadn't planned to get pregnant at that point. It just was one of those.
What happened was, we, after like about the 10th of my friends got pregnant, I just thought, you know what, this is something we actually need to be thinking about quite seriously. And we did want to have kids, really. So we started, and I remember thinking, started trying those. And I remember thinking, God, this is taking ages. And I think it took like 5 months.
Right.
Because I was just so naive. And then we got pregnant, and it was great. We found out that I was pregnant, I think, in early January. And I felt brilliant. It was just fab. And then we went, you know, I had all the tests and everything. And then when the day came to have the 12-week scan, we went into the hospital, and there was just this big empty space. And basically there was no embryo. And it was obviously really, really upsetting for reasons I probably don't need to explain, but it was just such a shock. When I went to the doctor and said that I was pregnant, they basically said, oh, don't eat deli meats and don't get a kitten because you get toxoplasmosis or something. I was like, right, okay. Nobody spoke to me about miscarriage in any capacity. And what happened to me was called a missed miscarriage. So it's basically where the fetus doesn't develop, but your body doesn't go through the normal process. And when I started talking about it, because I'm a relatively open person, I realized that this is happening all the time, like not necessarily missed miscarriages, but early miscarriage and later, but miscarriage is happening to everybody. And yet that was the one thing the doctor didn't talk to me about when I went to go and announce the fact that I was pregnant.
I mean, my wife and I went through the same experience, identical 12-week scan, you're skipping in. And the embryo wasn't viable, and exactly the same thing. She had to have one of those horrible DNC things. It was terrible.
Yeah.
I've been through that tiny bit of your journey, and
I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, I've got three lovely kids now, so it's sort of, don't really think about it. I know it's a terrible thing that no one ever talks about.
And I was told,
isn't it funny? It's not a thing.
No one talks about it, and when it happened, the sonographer wasn't fully trained to discuss it with us. So we knew something badly wrong was happening.
Fuck. Yeah,
we went into like the death room, whatever, where they've got pictures of the dying trees. And we got sent home hours later without an explanation. But when I finally did speak to a doctor about it, they said, "This is really common." I was like, "What? If it's really common, why don't I know about it?" And then she just said, "Look, unfortunately, every woman who has children has, on average, at least one miscarriage. You will get pregnant again." And this all just blew my mind. I was like, what? Anyway, to cut a long story short, we just didn't get pregnant again. And you have to wait a certain amount of time before you can go and see a consultant.
Mm.
So we did that. And then fast forward just over a year after we'd had this issue, we're sat in this, and I had lots of tests that you have. We're sat in this, in a sort of consulting room in hospital with the reproductive expert telling me that, if it's not happening, it's probably quite a problem. And I probably should have IVF sooner rather than later because I'm not getting any younger. And I think I'd just turned 35 by like 6 weeks. Right. Oh, and by the way, I'm really sorry, but because you're 35, there's no free treatment for you.
Gosh.
And it was just
dishing out the news, aren't they? Bloody hell.
Well, because, the guidelines are that every woman under 42, I think it is, should get 2 rounds. But of course, it depends where you live. And let's not go into that because it's, obviously a difficult decision for the NHS. But it was devastating for me personally, well, for us, but for me, because I went from being like, recently married, feeling pretty young, because I do think early 30s are quite young, suddenly being sat in this room, being told that I was just so past it that they weren't even going to bother trying to help me. And pretty much everybody I knew had a child at this point. And I wasn't ready to talk about it. So I had to go back into my daily life and deal with all of the conversations that everybody has every day about having a family, particularly at that age. And I was managing a team of people. So throughout this period, and we then embarked on IVF, but throughout that period of life, which probably lasted about 3 or 4 years, I didn't really talk about it that much. I mean, my close friends and family knew, but you're dealing with so much that you just can't really deal with telling everybody about your situation.
Well, such a strange situation because, they're saying kind of, look, you're gonna have some problems here, but there is a solution. It's called IVF. It's fucking expensive, frankly, but we'll come to that in a minute. So you're kind of this kind of slightly, and I've seen my friends go through it. It's sort of, there's still hope because there is hope, but there's a hell of a journey ahead. And it's at what point, and this is the way you told me the story back in the summer was really interesting. That it's like, what point do we park this dream, ambition, and start carving out a new story? And I guess, so just going back to this situation, so did they give you, I mean, I personally had a lot of medical crap in my life, and I quite like getting a name, a thing. Did they put a label on it, or was it just?
No, they didn't. And it's interesting you say that, because I do think that they know that everyone likes to have a diagnosis, because if you have a diagnosis, you can try and treat it. So, I mean, there were things which were possibly factors on both sides with both of us. But ultimately, everybody we spoke to said, you should be able to get pregnant. You should be getting pregnant. It's just a matter of time. And obviously, to begin with, that was good. That was great. That hope was like, good. We just need to keep going. But yeah, and what you and I spoke about at the Do lectures, hope actually can then become like just this really difficult thing to deal with, because at some point in this situation, I just wanted to get on with my life. And it was, not only was it costing us so much money, it was costing us so much in terms of like our quality of life and my other health in general, because it's just such a grueling thing to go through emotionally and physically, financially, and practically, logistically. It's just awful. And it was difficult for me because at the clinic, they are saying, well, do you want to have another go? Because you will get pregnant. You will get pregnant. And when you really want to have a family, of course, like that is such a tantalizing prospect. And when I started speaking to friends, it was quite interesting because they were like, oh, don't give up hope. There's always hope. And don't get me wrong, I love a bit of hope, right? But
yeah,
sometimes you just
tricky,
need to let
it?
go of it and move on. And that was the hardest thing, was when do you decide to move on? And it could come down to the fact you just haven't got any money left. It can come down to the fact that you're just so exhausted. And it was a combination of all those things. And I just thought, bloody hell, I'm like almost 30, like 8, 39. I've basically dedicated some of the prime years of my life to this. Mm. And I can't regret it, because at least I know that I will always know that I've tried what I could. But I do regret it in a way, because we spent so much money and energy on something which has come to nothing.
It's such a mind fuck.
I know, because, it really is.
Because we all know of stories, and yeah, I'm thinking of two of my friends in particular who you know, they, because inevitably you're not going to, the one last time you do it and you get pregnant, obviously will always be the last time, and who probably did go, fuck it, we'll do one more go, and then they did get pregnant, and you're going,
yeah.
And then you know, there's that doctor who, I can't remember his name, but you know the guy I'm referring to, who claims that he's got better results than anyone in the world, and so there's that kind of, it's like being in a casino. It's like being
it is exactly like that.
Do you know what I mean? Never walk away. You know, you're in. It's you're kind of, you're so sunk in the emotional journey and the financial journey,
are.
And you're kind of like, I'm going to double down. I'm going to have one last roll of the dice, but yeah. Actually.
And there comes a point where you just think, I'm throwing good money after bad here.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
what for? But I don't know how other people make that decision to walk away from it. Ours was sort of partly governed by the number of embryos that we had that were viable. And I wanted to stop, honestly, after three rounds, because I just couldn't go on anymore. And it was just so expensive. But we had this one viable embryo sitting in a freezer in Southampton. I was like, I cannot sign a document to destroy that, because that feels like our last hope. Yeah, I can't walk away from that and live a life knowing that it's there as this potential thing for us.
Yeah, that could be the one. Gosh.
It wasn't, as it happens, but I suppose so what in the end, like what we decided was, okay, look, we just need to give all of our embryos, viable embryos, a chance. And I had to really like get myself into this headspace, because I wasn't in that headspace. I wanted to move on. So I was like, right, okay, I'm going to like really get there. I'm going to be positive. I'm going to embrace this whole experience one last time. But in the background, I think I'd had started to try and move on with my life. And I was already in a space where I was thinking about, well, if we don't have children, what things could we do that we might not have been able to do otherwise? And I think I was still in a place where I was trying to rationalize that, like trying to make it,
yeah,
like, oh, but actually there's a positive life to lead. And I knew it rationally, but I didn't feel it in my heart of hearts. But something had got hold a little bit. And then I basically made an ultimatum. I was like, on the day that I do the pregnancy test after this last embryo transfer, the following day, I'm either going to be really happy because it's finally worked, and I will go on to lead this life which we expected, or I'm going to have my notice in at my job and I'm going to start my own business. And that might not have been the smartest thing to do, because it actually led to stress, because the whole time I was like, oh my God, my life's going to change on Tuesday, but I've got no idea how.
They say you should only tackle one serious thing at a time, and that may have been a bridge too far. One kind of question which I've again seen a little bit of in my friends that have gone through similar things. One was the kind of stress of on the marriage. Actually, it sort of ended up kind of driving them apart, really, to the point they're no longer together. And then the other was a kind of I don't know if this happened to you, but it's a tiny bit of a quirk where there was some blame apportioned by the doctors to the man, which was something, I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, you've got lazy sperm or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there were some other things they said, and that means you have to be fit and can't drink and can't. So
oh my
there
God,
was a
yeah.
bit, there
I
was
mean,
quite a sort of, a lot of emotional baggage suddenly tied up in this. Which I think that's just really cruel now, because you're going, well, actually, it's your fault. And actually, if you have that beer, that means, you know, it becomes very tricky.
It does, yeah.
How was your husband on this sort of journey? Was he both, was he, because again, sometimes people forget about the husband. They forget actually that, yes, you're all going through it, but maybe his whole identity has been about being a dad. And I just give us a shape of how he was dealing with all of this.
Yeah. He was stressed. It was really stressful. And he was doing everything he could, because ultimately that they couldn't, there were sort of small concerns with both parties, and me and him, but nothing that was pointing to actually any problem, you know, as in something that would prevent a pregnancy. So we kind of lucky, I think we're really lucky in that respect, because in some instances it is like, okay, one party is perfectly fertile and able to get pregnant, and the other isn't. And then I can imagine it's very, very difficult to keep going. And I have spoken to people, friends of mine or people I know, who had to go through a similar experience because of their partner's sperm. And that has been very, very hard, because then you sort of keep going back, well, if I'd had children with the other boyfriend. But anyway, luckily we didn't have to worry about that. But yeah, it was just, you know, like with men, they're like, oh, you know, can't cycle, can't have baths, can't drink beer. And so he was really good and tried to not do those things. But you've got to live your life. And we're talking about over the course of like 4 years, you just can't put all the things you love on hold. And then there definitely is a bit of resentment, which you have to, well, I tried really hard to keep at bay, because even though it wasn't my fault, fertility treatment only focuses on the woman. There are some things they can do for men, but basically it doesn't actually matter who's at fault, as it were. If your husband's got, you know, poor sperm situation, it's the woman who has to go through IVF. So even though 50% of infertility is male factor, it is always the woman who has to go through the treatment. And that, in the depths of like all of the hormonal sort of frustrations and the pain and the, that feels really, really unfair. And it can be hard to not blame your partner. Because they're just not going through it.
It's just such an emotive subject, isn't it? I mean, it wasn't that long ago, you know, where a woman that hadn't kids, couldn't have kids, was called barren. Is that right? I remember reading that.
Yeah, I know.
Dickens. And then, you know, when I was growing up, you know, if you sperm weren't right, you were a Jaffa, seedless oranges.
So I mean, awful.
Just awful sort of, you know, quite cruel. You know, you're dealing with enough shit anyway, that having horribly pointed, stupid names. So look, I guess, look, there's a few things here. There's the sort of coming to terms with it. Because let's be honest, we all, and you alluded to this earlier, you know, you're sort of pre-programmed to think what living your best life looks like. And it does look like a good job, a lovely husband or partner, kids, you know, health. And when you get curveballs coming along, like yours and my case, when I got cancer in my 30s, you're like, that wasn't part of the plan. And you know, it's very hard. And part of it is, I find, you know, is your, how your kind of friends react. And some, I've seen it a little bit with friends of mine who've got loads of kids, and then some other friends don't have kids, and they're a tiny bit sort of awkward and embarrassed. And it's a real can of worms, right? So first of all, yeah, how were you with your friends and family, or how were they? Was that a difficult part of the process, or were they all amazing?
I mean, generally, people are pretty amazing when you talk to them about this kind of thing. My family were absolutely just supportive all the way, and so were my friends. And I at the time had an amazing manager who knew about it and was extremely supportive. So I didn't have to face a lot of the problems that other people do. You know, a lot of people, depending on the sort of the society in which they live and their family background, have a lot more baggage to deal with. But it really messed with my sense of identity as a woman, because I didn't realize it until it was challenged. But I was like, oh my God, what am I if I'm a woman who can't have children? And I was just unpacking that, and I was like, actually, you know, going back, you know, thousands of years, iconography of women is all about sort of bountiful, selfless, nurturing, you know, mother to all. And then even as they grow up, it's then about being the wise old grandmother, and it's all linked to nurturing children and being fertile, and like all these fertility symbols. And you know, I get that they also have like a wider symbolism in terms of, I don't know, grains and harvest or whatever, but it is extremely difficult when you can't have children to be like, well, what kind of woman am I if I'm not a bountiful fertility goddess?
Yeah,
hard. You know, am I a barren old crone? Am I a selfish old spinster? And then you start thinking about your future and think, oh my God, who's going to look after me when I'm, you know, babbling away in a nursing home? And who's going to have me for Christmas when I'm in my 70s? I don't want to be that spinster auntie that everyone's like, oh God, is Auntie Emily coming for Christmas again? And you can really get yourself quite tied up in the space
of course.
How do I fit into the society if I don't have an immediate family unit that I have produced or have adopted?
So since you sort of made the decision that that was it and you were going to get on with recasting a new life, how long ago was that?
Probably about 18 months ago.
And again, I'm sort of, I guess for other people who are going through this or feel they might be going through this, you know, how did you, any, this sounds a bit flippant, but any thing that you thought was helpful in replanning your life, that's a life without being a you know, biological parent?
Yeah, and I do actually just want to say that if anybody is listening to this and they are going through something like this, it is awful, but it actually isn't the end of the world. And I thought it was, and it's okay if you think it is in the moment. But what was really, really helpful, the most important thing to me, was seeing other women talking about going through a similar experience. And no one's experience is exactly the same. It's really personal, but I had a really big moment when I was getting the train and I was in the concourse, and there were the newspaper stands outside WH Smith, and there was just Michelle Obama on the front cover of the paper saying, like, Michelle Obama opens up about IVF. And I'd just been told that I had to have IVF, and I couldn't accept it. And I just broke down in tears in the middle of this train station, because it was so amazing to me. I still, like, I'm getting emotional just thinking about that moment, because when I saw, like, Michelle Obama and Barack Obama had to have IVF to have their two children, honestly, that, like, changed something in me. I didn't want to do it. I still hated everything about it. But I was like, oh, if they had to have IVF, then I no longer feel like some kind of, like, broken citizen. They're two people that I really admire, and I think for me, like, represent a lot of positive stuff, people I'd really like to be a bit more like. So when I think she also spoke about marriage counseling, it was all part of when Becoming, her book, came out. And that was a big thing for me. So then I started quite greedily trying to find stories of women who openly were talking about IVF, and there weren't that many at the time. There are a few more now. That was really important. But then what happened was, when I realized it was not going to happen for me, I looked up and there were no, well, there were, but it was much harder to find positive, inspiring role models who were women openly talking about not having children.
Yeah.
Because what I needed was someone to say, I didn't have children, I wanted children, but look how good my life is. Or not even I wanted children, just I don't have children and I've got an amazing life, because I really just needed to, like, grasp on like a life raft to this possibility that actually my life could still be really great. And most of the stories about fertility troubles, whether they're IVF or not, they more often than not end in, however, like you said, we were just about to throw in the towel, and then we, you know, got pregnant one Christmas Eve when we were drunk, and we decided to, you know, it's like, I've heard so many of those stories. So I would say, try and find people who are talking about it, because it will just help you realize that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Did you meet anyone in particular, or were there any, was there any kind of inspiration? Was there somebody you met who actually was going, you know what, I don't have kids, or we don't have kids, but we get to do X, Y, and Z, and you go, okay, well, let's re-anchor around those sort of things. And I'm thinking sort of obvious stuff like, you know, traveling and being able to, you know, frankly, have a lot more cash to spend on things and just be a bit more selfish, actually, but yeah, maybe a bit more adventurous or stuff like that.
Yeah, and so I don't know if there was, I mean, Michelle Obama was a big one just on the IVF thing, but I don't know if there was one person, but when I started really looking around and actively, like, I mean, I became a bit obsessed. Every time, I still am a little bit, every time I see someone on the TV or meet someone and I suspect that they are a woman without a child, I'm just like, I need to know everything about you. And I in the most friendly way, but yeah. And it, so it was a collection of people. And actually, when I started to pay attention, I realized there had been people in my life who, you know, as a young child, friends of my mother's and friends of the family who didn't have children. And actually, if I really thought about it, they were some of the most interesting women that I knew. It's just, you become so, you get tunnel vision and you become so focused on this one thing. And it feels like when you're trying to get pregnant, every woman in the street is pregnant. And then everyone's got a family. And to a certain extent, that's kind of true if you're at that age. But when you look around and really search, you're like, oh, actually. So what I did was, over the course of that time, I just thought, right, if I get to 80 and I look back on my life, what would I have to have done in order for me to think it was a good life? And I just came down on these sort of three principles. And one was that I wanted to have seen a bit of the world. The other is that I want to have met interesting people along the way. And the third one was I want to feel like I've left some kind of positive impact, even if it's just on the people around me. If I can say on my 80th birthday, yeah, more or less, I achieved those things, then that's my starting point. And that could happen with or without children, because I was always quite conscious of not trying to paint having a family as a negative thing, because I did want it and it didn't happen. But I have lots of friends who have got families, and I don't want to be the person who can't be around them. I'm really happy for them. It just didn't happen for me, but it has taken me a very long time to really feel that and not just say that. That's really hard, because
I mean, it's a really profound thing to say, actually, to sort of acknowledge that, own it, and not, you said that without any, I felt that was quite an honest, authentic, there wasn't any sense of resentment or, do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, there's always two sides of the coin, right? And there are lots of positives about not having kids. I mean, I could give you 10 right now, and I had my daughter's fifth birthday party on Sunday, and I'm still recovering. It's, you know, and it isn't binary, and it's just, there is a brilliant life to be led without
children.
The hard thing is
accepting that, I mean, you never know what would have happened in an alternate, like, sliding doors moment, but I have to accept that if I'd had children, we'd probably be quite happy. And for a while, I had to almost, to get over how I felt on my situation, I had to make up scenarios in my head that meant that we wouldn't have been happy in that alternate life. Like, maybe, you know, I don't want to go into them because they can get quite dark, but, like, you know, I had to sort of almost kid myself into thinking it would have been bad. And like you say, it's not about good and bad. It just didn't happen. There was a course that I went on earlier on this year for women who had wanted children but couldn't have them. And actually, if anybody is listening to this, it's called Gateway Women. It's a really good community. And I just met a few other women who are in similar situations to me. And they were really incredible people, and they were suffering so much. And through that community, not necessarily just the women I met, but the women that part of the community, it just showed me quite a lot about the challenges, and I wasn't alone, and it made me really determined to not become bitter and to incorporate this into my story of my life, but not become bitter that other people had something that I wanted, because I do have other things too, and I just need to focus on them. But it's not always that easy. And nowadays, still, when someone tells me they're pregnant, most of the time I'm like, oh, good for you, if that's what you want, that's fab. But sometimes on a bad day, it just blindsides you, and it just, you just think, oh my God, we're never going to be a family, me and my husband. That's devastating. And I just have to live with the fact that it will always be something which is, has the power to knock me over. But
yeah, to throw you. Well, I think you're incredibly brave and honest talking about it now, actually. So, you know, it's really, I mean, it's good on you for owning it and sharing it, because I think it still is I still think it is probably a taboo, maybe, I don't know. I'm surprised there's not more, don't like the word, but I can't think of another one, sort of celebrities who've, I'm just thinking, Emma Thompson's the only person I think I've ever seen publicly talk about not having children. I can't.
Yeah.
There must be a few more, but remarkably few, maybe.
There are remarkably few. There really are. And I mean, there are so many reasons why a woman might not have a child. It's not just about infertility. And actually, this gateway women community isn't an infertility community. It's, you know, people who didn't find a partner, or, you know, whatever, people who, it doesn't matter. But if you wanted a child and you couldn't. So that really opened my eyes, because I met women there who had all sorts of stories, and actually not part of that community, but I met other women who had decided not to have children, but had really struggled with that decision. Because in a way, it's easier if the decision's taken away from you. I mean, it's not, because it's really hard.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not, but yeah, I can imagine.
It's out of my hands, right?
Perception, yeah.
Celebrity-wise, though, I suspect, well, it's just a really taboo thing. And I think you've got to be really confident in your position as a figure of, let's say, celebrity or authority, to think, well, I'm going to say this and accept that that's how I'm going to be known forevermore. You can just imagine that, you know, when people talk about it, the next 20 years of their life, every time the Daily Mail mentions them, it'd be like, you know, so-and-so, who was unable to conceive a baby.
Yeah, I can see that.
You're living your best life.
So just sort of finally, did the two lectures live up to your expectations? What was actually, just, I was, you know, just, how did you hear about the Do? What was it you were? I know we now know the context of why you went, but was there any? How was it for you?
It was brilliant. I loved it. It's, I mean, everyone says it, don't they? But it is just a unique little moment in time, and it was just really beautiful, and it was pretty stimulating. I had to have a little nap one afternoon. I just had to go and close my eyes for 20 minutes. I was like, too much information. But I loved it. I think there's a lot of... how did I hear about the Do? I'm not really sure. I think a friend told me or something, and I'd been following them for a while. I felt like there was a lot of pressure for the Do lectures to change your life. And sometimes, you know, people be talking like, oh, you know, what's been your Do moment? I'm like, oh my God, I don't know. Just the whole thing is incredible. The setting... One thing that really just struck me is it's unusual nowadays to be somewhere at a thing where there is so much soul.
Mm.
The care, like the attention to detail at the Do lectures, and the love that goes into it is like, that's the most overwhelming thing. It's just how much everybody wants to be there and how much everybody cares about it. And it comes across, and it just builds and builds and builds into this just like, overwhelmingly positive experience. So I loved it. Yeah.
It's really funny, isn't it? It's really hard to explain to people. And a lot of people, I think, do arrive with some sort of cynicism or at least questions. I mean, I know my 15-year-old daughter did. And even her, you know, with her cynical 15-year-old head on, by the end of it, I think we broke her.
We broke her.
I think she, in a good way, no, in a positive way.
With like, the communal singing.
yeah. I think, you know, or the band or whatever it was, I think, you know, a 15-year-old sort of teenager is quite at one end of a cynical spectrum, particularly with their dad doing what I was doing and doing a talk and just being me. But I think, you know, towards the end, even she was like, this is quite special. Wow. That's a hell of a story. And I, as I said, really appreciate your honesty, and I think it's just important that more people talk about it, and you know, I'm hoping, you know, lots of people got a lot from your chat today. I certainly did, and I, like I said, thank you very much for being so honest, and I really appreciate it. Cheers, Emily.
Thank you for having me. And I do just want to say that if anybody does want to talk about this stuff, then I'm on LinkedIn. They can just send me a message, because it was the most important thing for me to have people to talk to who understood. Because friends try to understand, but they can never really understand.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Emily for being a very authentic and honest guest, talking about a sensitive subject. But, you know, I felt she was very brave to speak so openly about something that is sadly still a bit, you know, of a tough conversation for people to talk about, and including me, actually, as I'm sure you heard. Anyway, thank you, Emily. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Please do leave us a review. Please subscribe. Please like, and please do spread the word, and please do drop me a note, gav@thedolectures.co.uk, if you have any feedback or suggestions on future guests. Yeah, and actually, for those of you that are listening in real time, the Do Lectures are actually live. They started yesterday on Thursday the 6th of July, and they go through till Sunday, so... yeah, I'm in West Wales with the gang, and, you know, excited to be going and excited to be there. And, yeah, I hopefully we'll get some more guests coming out of the main event. And, yeah, stay tuned. Thank you to Ashton Main for producing this podcast and for the fantastic music. And thank you very much to all of you for listening. Stay safe, take care, keep living your best life. And, yeah, talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.
Living Your Best Life with Gav Thompson.